Stand for the reading of the gospel, please. This is Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13. When that time comes, the ones who are walking Creator's good road from above will be like 10 young, unmarried women who took their ceremonial torches and went out to welcome the groom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. The wise women took an extra clay pot of oil along for their torches, but the foolish ones did not bother to bring any. The groom did not come when expected, and they all fell asleep as they waited. Then suddenly, in the dark of the night, someone cried out, "Look, the groom is coming. Let us go welcome him." All the women woke up to prepare their torches, but the oil in the torches had run out. The foolish ones said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, so our torches will not go out." The wise ones answered back, "There is not enough for all of us. Hurry, go to the village and trade for some more." They hurried away to get more oil. But while they were gone, the groom came, and all the guests went into the lodge for the wedding feast, and the gate was closed. A while later, the other women came to the gate and said to the gatekeeper, "Honored one, oh honored one, open the door and let us come in." But he said to them, "I truly do not even know who you are. Why should I let you in?" Here is what I'm saying to you. Be prepared like the wise women in this story, and always be ready, for you do not know the time of day or night that the true human being will appear. The word of the Lord. We are doing junior worship. Okay, yeah. Sing with me. Jesus loves me, this I know.
Well, good morning. It's been a while, but I did remember not to sing while my microphone's on. I quite enjoyed the reading of the New Testament texts in that First Nations translation. The language is just fresh enough and different enough that it draws you in. I hope you're enjoying that as well. I had not read that, by the way, that translation, while I was preparing for today. But I was really captured by the true human being as a translation, normally Son of Man. I could go off on that, but I'm not going to. I want to say I'm thankful for the gift to stand in this place with you. I noticed a difference as I anticipated this. I'm not real interested in standing in this place on Sunday mornings any longer. People ask me, "Do you miss preaching?" And my quick response is, "No, I don't." And in part, I think for me, it's because I come here and, like you, I get to hear Kevin read. And I appreciate Kevin. I value what he does. I actually value him more than what he says. But I do value what he says, and I don't take issue with a lot of what he says. I do some, and so here we are today. I hope for faithful words this morning. Words that are life-giving and not life-diminishing. I want you to know I love you as a people, and it means a great deal for me to be part of this community, be part of this communion. Did you know that yesterday was Veterans Day? Well, I want to tell you about an experience I had this year. It was on Friday, and Where I work, they celebrated Veterans Day on Friday. So I was part of a gathering in the chapel there at Mary's Woods for a Veterans Day. I don't know that I would call it celebration, but it did have celebration about it. It was really about honoring the veterans in the community. And let me tell you a little bit about me before I get to what happened there. I am what I consider a wannabe pacifist. I'm not going to comment on that. I'll just tell you so you can know. As a wannabe pacifist, to the part of me that resonates deeply with that, is opposed to all physical violence as being wrong, including military violence in the name of any nation. I've also toyed with the theology, I would call it quietism, which is somewhat reflected in our tradition, Churches of Christ. And quietism is a resistance to be involved in politics of a country. And I've toyed with that. It comes from a long stream and current connected to David Lipscomb, who is a noteworthy name in our tradition. And I admire how he lived through the Civil War, for example, as a non-participant. I'm also presently deeply opposed to Christian nationalism that has grown in our country. So I'm not going to comment on any of that. I just want you to know that that's the kind of guy who went into the chapel Friday for Veterans Day. And so you can imagine my experience. I walk in there Friday afternoon, and it is a room complete with color guard who process down the middle aisle right in front of the altar, carrying the American flag. They plant it right in the middle. So if you can imagine with me, right here. And I'm sitting about where John Wolfgang is right now in relationship to the flag. At some point, after some introductory language, we all say the Pledge of Allegiance while pointing ourselves toward the flag. And I can tell you, for me, in that moment, it was complicated. I felt conflicted by it. I felt like, and I guess you may feel a little of it with me, this sacred pull in my heart toward America and toward my home, my country. And there's a part of me, I think, even yet, where there's resonance between my faith and my country. But it's really complicated for me as well. And I will tell you, as I pledged allegiance, and I haven't said those words for a long time, so to say them takes me back somewhat to grade school, which was a couple days ago. And yet, there's something soul deep in me that resonates with the language of that pledge. It feels sacred and worshipful. And so that happens. I'm thankful, by the way, as all this is happening inside of me, that there's not some kind of placarded words telling the room around me what's happening with me. And then we sang the Star Spangled Banner. Well, we didn't. Someone did for us. I know better. And can you imagine what happened to me when we sang the Star Spangled Banner? I bet you can't. I was taken to a baseball field. The lush green, the beauty of this diamond, four corners, a pitching mound, 60 feet, 6 inches from home plate, 10 inches higher than home plate. I was there in the chapel at a baseball field. And all of that is just to simply say to you that each moment for all of us, every encounter that we have, We bring our personal experience with us. And it can't be but the case that we bring ourselves. All the attempts that we make, including the attempt I'm making right now, to communicate with one another, assume that we all bring distinctive experiences. When we reach out to another human in an effort to communicate with that human, we assume, we know tacitly, whether we know consciously or not, that that's happening. It comes with language, it comes with communication. And I want to suggest to you that when that happens, that all our values, our beliefs, our convictions come right along with us in the experience. Not because we invite them, they are there with us always. They are always there with the one we're attempting to communicate with as well. I don't want to get any deeper into that than just to say that at the beginning. But I do want you to remember my Star Spangled Banner experience in a chapel on Veterans Day. I was in a baseball field. As I sat down to write the sermon yesterday morning, I was reminded that if I was writing a sermon on Saturday morning, there was always a little guilt for me. It seemed a little late. Yesterday morning, I didn't have that feeling. I thought, this is the time that I have to do it. But I ran into these words. The magic of language as a force and a mystery. It is the magic of language as a force and a mystery that gives a writer hope and calling. I thought, those are some good words to read right before you're going to write a sermon. One more caveat. I haven't started the sermon yet, by the way. And it has been some time, so, and it'd probably be some time before I get to do this again. I am so appreciative of the time that we have taken in our community to explore the relationship between visual art and faith, poetry and faith, and now we're getting ready to do some reflecting around music and faith. And Pete did a little theater and faith thing this morning, which I appreciated. I think that's deep and significant work, by the way. And I applaud it. I think those who have shared their gifts with us, Michael, Brian, Donnie, that as they have allowed us to hear their own sifting of their faith through those interests and commitments that they have, that they invite us in. By the way, they invite us into their experience, their convictions, their beliefs, knowing that we come along with convictions and beliefs. And so, let me thank all of you for your hospitality in allowing that to happen here. I was going to say Winding Way, but this is East County. Wow. I'll say this, that it's your hospitality that allows those things to happen. And it might be that you have less appetite for art and poetry and music than others do. And I will admit to you, I relate to that in relationship to jazz music. I love jazz music for about 5 minutes. I don't then hate jazz, but I'm satiated with jazz. Satiated. Okay, now to the sermon. Our gospel text. I must admit, when I received the gospel text through the grace of Kevin Reed about a month ago, and I looked at the text and I thought, I don't know. A little later on in the negotiations with Kevin, he indicated to me that he wasn't so thoroughly committed to the lectionary that he could allow me to vary from it, which I really appreciated that grace, by the way. And I don't know that if he knew rhetorically when he made the move, I would go ahead and say, yeah, I'll go ahead with that text. But it did work. I've been living with that text now for a few weeks. I've been working through it a bit with Alpha, some of that more life-giving to her than other. But let me say this. Parables by genre, by their very nature, are an invitation to imagination and experience. Now, all communication is an invitation to those realities, but there are some forms of communication, like parables or poetry, that are especially and intentionally that kind of invitation. And I'm reminded that Mark says this about Jesus in his gospel, that with many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. He did not speak to them except in parables. Isn't that interesting? I'm not sure if Mark hadn't read the other gospels, he hadn't seen the Sermon on the Mount or what, but perhaps a little hyperbole. Jesus didn't speak in any other language, which is somewhat captivating to think that his words as he spoke were an invitation to our imagination and our experience. It's as you think of Jesus making that choice, brings up some questions for me. Is it that Jesus used parables because parables could do what prose couldn't do? That Jesus was attempting to describe a reality and inviting into a reality that could be obscure, could be what you might call a hidden message, a hidden reality? I wonder when I say that, why wouldn't Jesus just come right out and say it to ensure clarity and certainty for those of us who need clarity and certainty? Might feel left out hearing parables. And what are we to do if we don't have ears to hear? As Kevin has asked us, what do you do if you walk out and say, well, I guess I'm among those who couldn't hear it? And I don't really know what to say about that. I'll let you live with it. Perhaps there is an invitation, though, into the richness of something that can only be experienced through parables. And could it be that, like poetry, that the way of the kingdom resists this reduction to prose, and perhaps resists the reduction to certainty? Take the parable of the prodigal son. I am going to get to Matthew 25. Who is that parable, the prodigal son, about? Is it the son who goes off and wastes or squanders, which the word prodigal points us to? He squanders his inheritance. He comes home penniless because he doesn't have anywhere else to go. And we all can relate to that in some way at some times. Or is it perhaps really about the father who actually is the prodigal in this story, who throws away good money after bad? After having given the entire inheritance to his son, he comes home and he spends we don't know how much celebrating his return. Is it the father who's the prodigal here? And of course, what about the elder brother? I mean, who can resist taking a whack at the Pharisees among us? And I include myself when I say that as both whacker and wacky. That's not a word. Isn't it that the parable is really about all three and perhaps more? Because isn't it the case that language like this, and I would say all language, but especially this kind of language, always has an abundance of meaning? It always has more than we're going to get. And it's invitation from our own experience to come into the story, not to get the certain truth, you know, that's unraveled for us by someone with insight. It's an invitation to bring our experience to that. Have you ever been to a wedding? Have you ever received a wedding invitation? I think Matthew 25 probably recognizes that's a possibility that you bring, that you experience. One Jewish commentator, by the way, who is both Jewish, a woman, and continues to be committed to her Jewish faith, she's also a gospel scholar, which is an interesting mix. And this is what she says. The gospel writers, in their wisdom, left most of the parables as open narratives in order to invite us into engagement with them. Each reader will hear a distinct message and may find that the same parable leaves multiple impressions over time. Different audiences inevitably hear different messages. Therefore, reducing the parables to a single message destroys their aesthetic as well as their ethical potential. Isn't that good? I mean, that is an invitation to walk out of here today and say, you know, I'm not sure what that parable meant to Lewis. I'm not sure what it meant to me. Or maybe this is what it meant to me, and I will take that with me. Not unlike what Pete said about Les Mis, by the way, that it lingers. I think these are things that as they linger, have transformative power. And I would even say that as I lingered with Matthew 25 and the parable of the bridesmaids, young maidens, virgins, whatever we call them, on first reading, I was a bit nonplussed. But as I've lingered with it and had it linger with me, I've come with something different. A little different. And so I invite you first just to hear my experience of the parable and then take the parable with you. See what it will do for you. So we imagine a wedding. We have 10 people who are participant attendants of the wedding, who are looking forward to the arrival of the bridegroom. And I think at some level, Jesus is awakening all of us to the possibility, not unlike Amos 5, to the possibility that while we're anticipating the arrival of God or gospel or goodness or kingdom, while we may be anticipating that, we may not be prepared for it. And we may be surprised by that. As I sat with the parable, I was reminded that it's part of three parables in Matthew 25, all of which have this common element: an absent but coming presence. An absent but coming presence. A bridegroom, a master who has slaves, and the Son of Man. And perhaps that third parable isn't really a parable, but a description of the judgment. The sheep and the goats. There are a good number of options with Matthew 25 and that parable of the virgins. What I've been drawn to is the image of Jesus saying that when we care for the least of these, we've cared for him. And so I brought that back with me to the bridesmaids. Could it be that what the oil could represent that these foolish and wise virgins have, could it be that that's a symbolic way of describing our experience of Jesus, the presence of Jesus, that there is this hidden presence of Jesus available to us, but we may miss it. And there's this invitation, and I don't offer this as threat to you this morning, but invitation. Not coercive, but perhaps insistent invitation that Jesus, in his absence, seeming absence, remains present. You remember Matthew in the beginning of the gospel says that it is Emmanuel who has come, that is God with us. It is Jesus who says in Matthew 18, whenever two or three are gathered, I am there, I am with you. It is Jesus who says in this gospel at the end, in the commission, that I will be with you always, even until the end. And it's interesting then that we have this absent, but I would suggest also present one. And that there's this invitation into the experience of this present one here for us. I'm reminded as I was preparing this week, actually weeks, of Mother Teresa's words about her work among those who are the least. Do you remember what she said about that? It's been some time ago, but that she experienced in those she served, sick, dying, poor, abandoned, she experienced in them Jesus in his distressing disguise. I love that. That is captivating. Don't over-sentimentalize it. It is Jesus where we don't expect Jesus in the presence of folks like that. Which, behind that, I would suggest is God present in Jesus on the cross in the last place we would expect it. And could it be that the invitation here is this present, absent one, seemingly absent, and we may miss it. We may miss the experience of Christ here and now because we're waiting for him. We're waiting for him. And could it be that the invitation then is this present experience, not simply Jesus in his distressing disguise, yes, that, but Jesus in his life-giving, joy-filled presence among us and in our world at all times and all places, I would say. And the language in the tradition that describes this, that kind of gets at this, is a sacramental creation, a sacramental view of creation. And the word sacrament here meaning that it is the invisible being made visible. It is the invisible being made visible, that in our experience, this invisible one becomes concrete. And we experience that one. And could it be that the story is, if you experience this one now and you live toward that coming, you live not only in the presence, but in the completion of that relationship. And so that when Jesus arrives, whatever that could mean, whatever that may mean, I've already experienced the presence of Jesus. I've been one who has journeyed with and seen Jesus in the world. I see, back to Les Mis, that when I look in the face of another, I see the face of God. There's possibility there for us. And I would suggest, in a non-coercive but insistent way, God is present everywhere at all times. In the community where I work, we have a community dog in one of the neighborhoods. Her name is Jazzy. She's a full-size black poodle, and she is gorgeous. And she is made for a community, I think any community, but she is made for a community like mine. And when you come into a room where Jazzy is, like most dogs, she's going to greet you. And she wants you to greet her and acknowledge her. And, you know, I'll sit down and she'll come up to me and I'll pet her. You know, and if a dog didn't come to me, come to anybody. I'm petting her, enjoying her. You know, it's kind of like Jazz and Jazzy. It's just a couple minutes, I'm done. Jazzy isn't done. So what Jazzy does, just a little nudge with her nozzle, she just touches your hand. And if that doesn't work, she'll put her little paw up. Well, it's not really a little paw. She's a good-sized girl. She puts her paw up, not on you, but on the chair next. And I want to suggest that is God nudging. I'm here. Insistent, I'm here. When I see someone who I may want to turn away from, I'm here. It could be someone gathered on a Friday afternoon in a chapel, honoring veterans, who I want to reduce to something that I don't want anything to do with. And yet I'm feeling the complicity of being there. And what I realize as I'm there and I'm drawn into the experience, that those who I would want to reduce to other and push away are actually, for me, the presence of God. It's complicated. I didn't leave Friday afternoon with any significantly different views about pacifism or about Christian nationalism. But I did change in the way I related to those humans who were with me and the experience of God and their loyalty and their willingness to sacrifice and their way of honoring others who would do that. I don't know if you noticed what I'm wearing today. I'm wearing red, white, and blue. Maybe the only one here today wearing red, white, and blue. And it is my nuanced recognition of what was given to me that day. So I want to end with this. I wonder if we live our lives in such a way that we can move toward the end of life, whether it is the coming of Jesus or the end of your life here on earth, that somehow that could be filled with some anticipation instead of dread, only dread. Eugene Peterson, who was the author of The Message, not only New Testament, complete canon, he translated, which is, I don't know how anyone could do that. He did. And I consider that a wonderful gift. You may not know, but Eugene Peterson was a lifelong pastor. Well, not lifelong, but he lived in becoming a pastor. And he wrote a number of books on pastoral leadership. What does it mean to be a pastor? Eugene died a few years ago. I want to say maybe five or six years ago. Before he died, he developed some form of dementia, perhaps Alzheimer's. And as his memory slipped away, his son shared about a time when he read one of his own books. And he read the book, he didn't recognize that it was his own, and after reading it, he said, "That person is a pastor." Don't you love that? Yes. That even though he lost enough that he didn't recognize his own writing, he recognized the heart of a pastor. By the way, this is a caveat, but it's a short one. Kevin Reed is a pastor. I watch him intentionally pastor, and I'm impressed. I love that about Kevin. Back to Eugene. So in his last days, his son was there with him, and Eugene sharing his struggle, his confusion. And his son, in trying to comfort his dad, said, "It's all going to be all right, Dad." "All things will be well. All things will be well." Which is the beginning of a very well-known Christian quote. Julian of Norwich. Eugene's eyes kind of lit up when his son said that. And he finished, "And all manner of things shall be well." It was in his heart. beyond his head. What a lovely thing to imagine that as he was losing so much of what he knew, that he had that experience inside of him. And in his final days, as he neared death, he was being cared for by a hospice person. And he startled the person because he jumped up and said, "Let's go." She didn't know what to make of it. I don't think he knew what to make of it. But in a memoir that he had written a number of years before, he referenced a Denise Levertov poem that helped describe his journey into being a pastor, which he had never thought he would be. He was going to be an academic when he started, but he became a pastor. And Levertov has this poem where she describes her journey into being a poet. And it ends with these words, "Every step an arrival." And she uses the image of a dog, not unlike Jazzy, where I work. And that for the dog, it's not getting to a destination and moving through a series of steps or points. Every step is an arrival. Every step is an arrival. And I would twist it just a little bit to say, every step is in the presence of. Not only waiting for the end, it is stepping in the presence of the one who has come to give us life. And then I think what we might say with Eugene is, let's go. Let's go. I think one of the things we do on Sunday mornings in our humble efforts is to awaken ourselves to the presence of this one who is not only present here, but everywhere and at all times and in all of creation. Could it be that we become a sacramental presence to our world, the visible expression of the invisible, the more we become aware that he is here? Thank you. Amen.